think we can start. So I'm very pleased to welcome Jennifer Nagel back for the third lecture. Sorry I couldn't be at the first two, but there are very good recordings on the web for people who have to miss some. And it's on mental state recognition among animals. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ursula. And thanks to all of you who have come out today. I appreciate your being here. Animals of all kinds naturally learn from their daily interactions with the environment. The last lecture explored a mechanism, curiosity, that accelerates this learning. Curious animals actively seek out educational experiences, with surprise functioning as a marker of the type of experience that's especially educational. Last time, I maintained a restricted focus on the individual animal. It builds expectations concerning the environment. And when those expectations are violated, it experiences surprise and it learns all by itself, thanks to its individual reactive prediction error correction learning mechanisms. Because curious animals derive reward from surprise, they are motivated to seek out, they're motivated to act in ways that challenge and therefore end up strengthening their existing grasp of reality as they explore new territory and toy with unfamiliar materials. The ensuing cognitive adaptation to reality is knowledge, I argued, because what is knowledge? It's a state of mind of a type that one can have only to truths. And the truth of the relevant truth action-guiding representations, that is mental states, is essential to their stable existence in an agent who keeps interacting with the environment in this manner. Being true is like the best way to continue to survive if you're a mental representation caught up in this tough antagonistic process. So this individual level story holds for an animal that's entirely alone in the world, you know, some kind of sad, last of its kind scenario. You could have such an animal curiously exploring an otherwise completely inanimate landscape. Now, mercifully, animals are not alone in the world. And this brings us to another way in which some experiences can be more educational than others. When an animal's environment contains another sentient creature, the learning situation changes in two ways. First, other living creatures present a learning challenge. Their behavior is hard to predict. Animals are complex. Second, other living creatures deliver a learning advantage, a bonus, if you will. Given their intelligence, their actions provide helpful cues to features of the shared environment. Psychological research on mental state attribution has focused overwhelmingly on that first dimension of social cognition, which I call agent-focused mind reading. I think it's easy to see why. The cognitive challenge posed by the presence of other agents is really considerable because agents make exceptions, if you will, to the rules of folk physics that govern the motions of other objects in nature. Unlike logs floating downstream, agents have agendas, and experiments can be designed to measure how well observing animals are picking up on that fact. So animals are, of course, subject to the laws of physics like anything else, dragged downstream by the current. But we've got our own agendas as well. We act as a function of our epistemic and motivational states. So, and unlike the mechanical forces on the floating log, which always immediately dictate what happens to it, you know, as it bumps against a rock or whatever, mental states produce action in a way that plays out over variable timescales. I think Hoey and Palmer's 2014 article is very helpful on that. And actually also Sergio Tenenbaum's Rational Powers in Action focuses a lot on the temporal dimension of action. In any event, maybe an animal learns something And then only much later, because of some long-term goal that it has, it sees an opportunity to capitalize on its knowledge, and it acts just when it senses that opportunity. What mind reading or mental state detection, I'm going to keep using those terms interchangeably, what it does is it gives us a chance to basically read the agendas of other animals, right? Take a look at the maps that they've been making of reality, track what they can now sense. This enables us to anticipate what those other agents will do across time and in changing circumstances. Predicting what other agents will do is often characterized as the core purpose of mind reading. On this view, genuine mental state attribution means getting inside the head of the other agent, seeing things from its perspective, finding its measure of independence from those overwhelming, boring folk physics laws that are governing everything else, as opposed to just maybe spotting regularities between its motion and other events in nature. The way you might spot regularities between anything else, like what's the special magic of those pesky agents. The classic test of agent-focused mind reading is the unexpected transfer task, Wimmer and Perner, 1983. In the original version of the task, which many of you will be familiar with, but I'll walk through anyway, you've got two opaque containers. Between the focal animal, that's the term for the animal whose mind reading powers are being studied, and the target animal, which is the animal that our focal animal is witnessing, the animal that whose head the focal animal is trying to get into. In the unexpected transfer task, a desirable object such as a grape is placed in opaque container A in full view of both animals. And then the target animal is perhaps distracted or turns away for a moment. And at precisely that moment, the grape is surreptitiously moved to opaque container number B. And letter B, whatever. And the focal animal, the question is, when the target animal turns back and reaches for the grape, where does our focal animal expect it to reach? If the focal animal expects that target to reach in container A, where the target animal last saw the grape, then our focal animal has just passed the explicit false belief test. They have gotten inside the head of that target animal, and they've shown that they can, in some sense, see the world from the perspective of the target agent, even when that perspective is out of line with how things actually are right now. The grape is now in B. Humans are the only animal capable of passing this test, and yes, I'll talk about the controversy, including dolphins, today, but there are easier tests of agent-focused mind reading that all kinds of non-human animals, various kinds of non-human animals, can pass. In particular, they can pass tests of a capacity to discriminate between knowledge and ignorance. But before digging into that research, I want to take a moment to highlight the second way that the learning situation changes when another animal enters the scene, the positive way, the learning bonus delivered by the presence of another intelligent animal, and this is what I call world-focused mind reading. So the actions of other animals, a sudden shift in gaze direction, you know, a moment of recoiling, those serve as clues about what's going on in the larger environment, and they're especially salient clues if the other animal is a conspecific, a member of your kind, likely to share your tastes, share your fears. Because the lessons here concern elements of reality beyond the target animal, and because the relevant mind reading bit is so automatic for us, it's really easy for us to forget that there's any mind reading involved here at all. And yet, decoding the significance of a shift in gaze direction, that can take some real expertise with the concept of seeing, as we'll see shortly. So, as I say, research on mind reading focused hugely on this first agent-focused dimension and on the way in which mind reading has got to solve that challenge of predicting tricky animal behavior. Less attention to the second. And I think this is a mistake. And it's actually a mistake that has led to misinterpreting some important experiments as showing failures in agent-focused mind reading, where in fact these experiments should be read as showing success in world-focused mind reading. And in particular, this has happened with tests of Getty or case recognition, which our animal behavior scientist friends have not even realized are tests of, of Getty or case recognition. We'll talk about those in a minute, too. Okay, I should say, though, to underscore the foundational character of the bonus world-focused dimension of mind reading isn't to say that it's always easy. So I want to describe a kind of complicated task that's also world-focused mind reading. And in some ways, a little little parallel to that Wimmer and Perriner task. So this is from Crouch and Carpenter and I think Tom Sells on this paper too, 2009, and there's a little diagram on your handout. The task is world-focused, as far as I'm concerned, because all the focal animal wants to do is get the raisins. It just wants to find the food. It's not actually interested in the behavior of the competitor per se. It's just looking at the, trying to get the food. It's going to maybe try to use the other animal's action as a cue to get it. Okay, so in this experiment, your participant P, and Cretchen used a couple different kinds of apes and also small children as participants. I'll just talk about the apes because they're the ones we care about here. Watched a human competitor, and the human competitor could see that food was being placed in one of two containers. But the ape's view is blocked, so the ape can't see for himself, herself, let's say, that the human competitor, who's going to be he now to keep things straight, that the human competitor, so she can see that he can tell where the food is being placed, but she can't herself tell where the food is being placed because her line of sight is a little blocked. So food gets placed in exactly one of the containers, and the competitor knows where, our focal ape doesn't. And now our competitor's attention is distracted for just a moment. He turns away, and an interloping experimenter switches the position of the two containers. The containers are on a sliding platform in between the two participants who can't quite reach it. But now they're given a chance to start reaching, and basically what the smart ape should do is if the competitor goes for one canister to get the grapes or bananas, the ape should go for the other. That would be a demonstration that they get this idea of false belief. Again, no non-human animal does this. Only children do it, and they only do it when they're 4 or 5 years of age. So they don't get that false belief. You've been tricked, so I should do the opposite of what you're doing. Lesson. But there's a version, a variant of the very same task that apes do pass. It's just, it's exactly the same setup as before. The only thing is now what happens is the containers are switched in full view of both participants. So your competitor's looking as the containers are switched. And now as the competitor reaches, your ape should go for the same canister, right? Because your competitor knew throughout where the food was, and apes do well at this. They're well above chance. And you've got control conditions that rule out a bunch of alternative interpretations of the task, like, are they always just reaching to the same container? No, they're not. Okay. I see this as evidence that chimpanzees are capable of detecting knowledge WH, knowledge where. This other competitor knows where the food is. I don't know where it is, but he knows where it is. But others might see it differently, including Carla Crutchen herself, who labels the condition a true belief condition. She doesn't label it knowledge. Now, I should emphasize throughout, I accept the classical entailment of knowledge to true belief. I think that's fine. But I think it's actually a live question. What is the state that the ape is detecting? And I'm going to be arguing today, it's misleading to call it a true belief condition, because what gets detected is knowledge. Apes never detect belief, whether true or false. They do detect states of knowledge and ignorance. I'm going to try to explain why. It has to do with the kinds of generalizations that they're capable of making. Their much misunderstood performance on Getty or case problems is a key part of the puzzle. But we're going to start with a simpler case. Before we get into sensitivity to epistemic states of knowledge and ignorance, we're going to talk about sensitivity to perceptual states. And I'll just here focus on sight because there's more research on that than any of the other senses. Keep it simple. Okay, so discussions of sensitivity to seeing customarily begin with a distinction between direct and averted gaze. In direct gaze, you have eye contact with another animal. Eye contact is necessarily mutual. I always feel like I have to stare at someone when I say that. It's necessarily mutual. The one thing I know about Karen right now is, as I'm seeing her, okay, sorry to put you on the hot spot. So it's a powerful signal of engagement or threat in contexts ranging from mating to predation. Now I won't look at anybody. Okay, for the stalking predator, the prey animal, for the stalking predator and also for the prey animal who's nervously foraging in the shadows, the moment of mutual recognition, when they lock eyes with each other, that sparks a big response, each anticipating sudden action in the other. Instinct, which whether innate or learned, instincts to pounce intersect with instincts to flee, with the swiftness of the leap balanced against the agility of the escape by a long evolutionary history. You have the predator, you know, it's got this sort of exquisite timing on that ballistic jump, and the prey animal might have the instinct to freeze for a moment before it starts its zigzag flight because it wants to do that kind of, I learned about this from Sergio, like outwitting the football goalie thing where you wait till they start, same deal. Okay, because if it starts jumping, well, anyway, okay. I shouldn't talk about sports because then I get very confused. Where am I? All right, okay. There's this symmetry between two vision-based agents. Busted, right? He saw me. I didn't want to be seen. I'm a predator. I didn't want to be seen. I'm a prey animal. I didn't want to be seen. But now that we've locked eyes, there's this huge moment. I think the powerful reactions arising from a moment of direct gaze do not demand a representation of this epistemic symmetry in either animal. The reaction is sparked by the existence of that symmetry and not by a representation of it. Okay, sensitivity to averted or dyctic gaze is subtler, also much easier to talk about, because I'm not making anybody nervous by looking at them in the eye. In dyctic gaze tracking, animals look towards the target of another creature's object-directed gaze. Now I feel like I'm addressing the chair. This is very strange. All right. First, it starts with you look at objects within the shared visual field, and then your gaze following into distant space, and then your geometrical gaze following. So, for example, if a creature facing you is evidently reacting to something back there, if you turn to look, that's called geometrical gaze following. And it's kind of complicated. So if you read the Steve Shepard review here, which I strongly recommend, there's this idea that in geometric gaze following, you are integrating egocentric and allocentric space. That's just like a really powerful set of computations to make. Many species show some capacity for geometrical gaze following, including dolphins, goats, dogs, all kinds of primates, maybe lizards. There's some geckos seem to be up to it. This ability has more and less advanced forms, and to get a sense of them, we can look at some work by Thomas Bunyar and colleagues on various bird species. So the more basic form of dyctic gaze tracking is exhibited by birds like the northern bald ibis, this beautiful plump creature illustrated on your handout. As context, these birds are at risk of predation from hawks circling above. When one ibis looks up and fixates on some point in the sky, a bunch of the other guys in the flock will turn and look up as well, kind of like tourists in New York. And the ordinary, boring blue sky has a higher chance of featuring something surprising when an ibis is looking up at it, right? So if you think about curious animals gaining reward for surprise, they could get that gaze alignment orientation response just through regular reinforcement learning, right? Even if they're just looking randomly at first, if they should be able to, over time, learn to learn to coordinate gaze. That's the kind of take that people like Gideon Dieck are making in the cited article. Anyway, whether it's installed innately or, as I think, through reinforcement learning, there's an interesting asymmetry in this response. So many people write about gaze alignment as just like, oh, the two animals like snap their gaze so they're looking the same way. No. A purely symmetrical desire to align would have that upward gazing ibis turn and look down because that's where most of the flock are looking. They're like, you know, eating their grubs in the sand the way they do. The head down posture is the more common one, given these guys are foraging on worms and larvae. No, it's the bird that's doing something unusual, fixating gaze upwards. That attracts attention. And gaze trackers follow that leader, that thought leader, to learn something new. Okay, research into the limits of ibis gaze tracking starts by taking advantage of the fact that, like a house cat, the ibis will follow a laser pointer projection if you shine it on the wall of its enclosure. So there's one experiment. This is Bunyar and colleagues. Actually, it's the lead author Loretto, but Bunyar is Bunyar's lab, illustrated on your handout. You get pairs of these birds, and you put them in separate rooms where they have free vision of each other at the bottom. They've got a 50-centimeter tall space they could walk under. But at the top, there's a 1-meter solid wooden partition coming down from the ceiling that's opaque. And you shine a laser pointer on one side of the barrier so that guys who are on that side of the barrier will look up at the spot. And you've got a ibis on the other side of the barrier who can see this buddy looking up. But of course, he can't see anything on his side of the wood. And the ibis on the other side of the barrier will also just look up, even though there's just like nothing to see. And then that's it. That's what they do. Now, birds that are a bit smarter, like ravens, I shouldn't rank, but I rank, they react just like the ibises when they're 2-month-old fledglings. By the time they're 6 months, they do what chimpanzees and all kinds of other creatures do who have geometrical gaze following. They hop under the barrier to go around to the other side to check out to check out that exciting laser spot action on the other side. Okay. And one thing I'll just comment on is that, wait, I won't comment on that yet. Oh, I'll say something else. The raven capacity to grasp seeing is illustrated even more dramatically in another experiment at Bunyar's, in which ravens figured out that they could be seen through peepholes, like these little apartment door style peepholes that they had spied through earlier, even when they were themselves far enough away from the peepholes that they couldn't see them through them anymore. So it wasn't like a window where obviously if I can see you, you can see me. Ravens' stronger abilities for tracking occluded sight lines are important in the densely forested habitats that they naturally inhabit. And by contrast, the northern bald ibis is a cliff-dwelling bird. It's out there in the open space. No wonder it doesn't know about obstructions. The peephole experiments show that ravens are smart enough to figure out situations involving an asymmetry of sight lines. But in dense foliage, this could often enough be the case as one raven peeps out through a small gap in the leaves at another out in the open. Ravens and other corvids also differ from ibises in having important competitive experiences as scavengers who hide or cache food for later consumption. So they get these 400, 500 kilogram bison carcasses in the forest in northern Siberia. Raven only eats 45 grams of meat a day. So it takes little strips of meat and it puts them in hiding places all around the forest. The scavengers pilfer each other's caches whenever they can. They don't find their caches by smell. They do it two ways, by memory, where they remember where they themselves hid stuff, and by having spied on someone else making caches. And there's kind of a little bit of a free rider problem here, because if you're down around the carcass, there's wolves and stuff down there, that's a little dangerous. You'd actually be kind of better off just hanging back and like watching where everyone else is going. But Ravens are really socially savvy, so they're much more private. If someone's watching me, I'm going to wait and like not cash. And anyway, so it all works out. And there's this kind of social cognition arms race between ravens attempting to cash as privately as possible and attempting to remain out of sight while spying on each other caching. So it's really vital in their ecology to grasp what other birds can and can't see. Natural selection and reinforcement learning generally make you as smart as you need to be in order to thrive in your natural and social environment. So I think there's two types of learning about seeing. There's lessons about what points positively fall within another creature's field of view. And there's lessons about what points are occluded. And thank you, Tim, for Timothy Williamson, for reminding me of this. It's so automatic for us that it's really hard to see this as an accomplishment. But if you've ever played hide and seek with a toddler, you'll know what I'm talking about. It's like, you can't see me. You know, it's sort of interesting. There's sort of interesting generalizations on both sides, both about seeing and about occluding. Both the positive and the negative side have some systematicity to them. So on the positive side, think about how you learn about what's falling in someone's range of view as they turn their head from side to side. On the negative side, think about what you learn about how low you have to hold your phone under the desk in order to text without attracting the speaker's attention. Thanks for being so discreet. I can't see anybody. All right. Mirrors and spotlights add complexity to the positive side of what can be seen. Patches of darkness add complexity to the negative side as you hide in the shadows, texting. And there's like different kinds of behavior hitting on both sides, right? Like I'm getting away with murder down here and whatever. And of course there can be question mark zones between those clear positives and clear negatives. We're not even going to worry about those until we talk about humans, really. The ibis or fledgling raven has taken a step in the positive direction when it looks up on seeing another agent look up, projecting the range of what's seen out in the upward direction towards which the target agent's face is oriented. The mature raven who hops under the barrier has learned something about that negative side, about obstructions. So whatever it is that the other agent is looking at, and it's really interesting in the course of learning, it's like it's driven by this presupposition that the other agent must be looking at something worth seeing. It's got to be on that other side of the barrier. And the peephole experiment ravens, they're learning an even more subtle positive lesson, projecting visual field out from the uncovered peephole. So there's similar ongoing refinements in the gaze tracking capacities of a lot of different animals, especially social animals. Ravens are outstanding, but other animals also show impressive abilities, especially primates. So infant apes follow gaze to the objects in the shared visual field. By the time they're 2 or 3 years old, apes will follow gaze geometrically. By the age of 4, apes are understanding more complex barriers with windows. I think I have the references for all this on your handout. And by age 5, apes will do the double check, where if you stand there and just like stare at empty space, the ape will follow your gaze at first and not see anything there and look back at you to check. And dogs do that too, but wolves do not. Okay, tracking knowledge and ignorance. An animal's behavior depends not only on what it's sensing right now, but also what it's learned over time. A series of perceptions can congeal into a lasting state of knowledge whose effects play out over various scales, time scales. The competitor who's witnessed food being hidden even a while ago is in a very different position from the competitor who didn't see that go down. The first experimental demonstration of knowledge attribution that I know about in corvids involved scrub jays who were given a chance to cache hide worms in ice cube trays filled with sand, either while being observed by jays who were looking at them through a window in an adjacent cage, or privately with the curtain drawn so the observers couldn't see. Then, 3 hours later, with no observers present, the jays were allowed back into the zone to recover their caches. At this point, if they wanted, they could dig up and eat their grubs. Or they could do this thing that jays do, which is rebury their grubs in different locations. And the ones who had been observed during their initial caching did a lot of reburying, a lot more than the ones who hadn't been observed. So you might think, okay, great, that shows that they're representing those competitors as knowing where the grubs are. But that mental state attribution might be a little bit fast because there's an easier way to explain it. You could just think, any cash I make under conditions of observation is a tainted cash. It's compromised. It's like it's got the evil eye on it. And again, that's the kind of thing you could learn through reinforcement learning, right? Anytime I cash and there's guys watching me, I go to dig it up later and it's not there. So yeah, whatever. But there's subsequent work with ravens, close enough, that I think rules out that kind of interpretation. So this is back to Bunyar and Cottrell. No, it's Bunyar and Heinrich, 2005. Ravens tend to avoid visiting a previous cache that they had made when a competitor can see them, unless, this is the exception, unless that competitor was there at the beginning and watched them hide that food there. So the idea is kind of like, yeah, if a particular raven already knows that this cache is here, I'm not tipping him off by revisiting the site, but I do have to be careful not to tip off anybody who's naive. So it really feels like they keep track of this difference between knowledge and ignorance as a mental state housed in a particular member of their kind. They have great face recognition. They keep track of who's who. Okay, despite their remarkable social intelligence, corvids seem incapable of passing tests of false belief attribution. And here I'll talk about Katarina Breck's doctoral research with Eurasian jays. They systematically miss the chance to exploit the false belief of a would-be pilferer in a competitive caching paradigm. The paradigm involves clear plastic lids being taken on and off these trays in which you get to hide stuff. And it's kind of like background context that all the birds know that late in the day there's going to be party time when all the lids come off. But during the caching, they've got these hard plastic lids that you can't peck through on some of the trays but not others. And basically, a jay could pass the test if he could represent his rival as being unaware that a particular tray was in fact accessible during a period of private caching. So there's this moment, once again, where we draw the curtain and we take the lid off a tray that's usually covered. Now, there's a bunch of other trays around. And if you were really smart, you'd go and put all your peanuts in there, right? Because you'd be expecting this other guy to represent that as inaccessible. So you could just take advantage of your conspecifics false belief to hide your peanuts in a tray that the other guy won't be expecting. And it's actually really puzzling that they don't pass this test because it's not inherently more complex, although I didn't explain it very well, to a human eye than those knowledge ignorance tests, which corvids really do succeed at. And I think one possible theory about why they're failing is that there's something that the human eye can see that the corvid eye can't. That was metaphorical. I mean, there's a difference in the cognitive resources available to the human and corvid mind. Corvids are clearly intelligent. They learn from past experience. They develop a model of the world that extends well beyond their current sensory scope. So they can remember the location of all these caches that they've made, even ones they've made a month ago. There is a question about whether this model in the corvid mind also represents the temporal dimension of reality. If ravens recached their grubs when they were observed during caching, you might think that shows they remember that past experience of having been watched, worse, having been watched by that guy, right? And accordingly, some researchers have proposed that corvids have episodic memory. They have mental time travel. They can go back to that time when that guy was watching me. Clayton and Dickinson have some really great work on this, which I won't summarize because I'll talk about it for a long time if I get into it. I have to. So, sorry. I'll do the quick version. Scrub jays seem to track the difference between worms that I buried 4 hours ago, which are still juicy, fresh, and tasty, and better than peanuts, and worms that I buried 5 days ago, which are just not so great now, and actually peanuts are better. And they're going to choose the peanuts over the worm tray if it's fresh worms, but not if it's really old worms. And yeah, they're not doing this by smell. They're doing it by something more like memory. But what Christoph Hurl and Teresa McCormick have argued in this 2019 BBS Target article that I cite on the handout, and I think that they make an extremely convincing case for this, is that non-human animals have models of the world, but they only ever represent how things are now. Not how things were and not how things will or might be. The models, of course, based on what the animals learned over time, even though other times are not represented in the model as such, perishables like the cached worms just fade out from the world over time, fade out from the map of the world, thanks to basically an interval timing mechanism. So that's called a temporal updating system, and it just deals with changing input by changing the representation rather than by representing change, as they put it. So in this theory, all animals have this temporal updating system for the present moment, and only humans have a full-blown temporal reasoning system alongside it, which enables mental time travel. I'm going to actually come back, maybe in lecture six, to that temporal updating system, which we have. Maybe it plays a role in things like knowing where your car is parked, even though you can't see it out the window right now. And notice also that your representation of whether the worms are still there or not could count as knowledge if it's generally being formed by patterns of experience with things that actually really do drop off the map after a certain period of time. Okay, so the full-blown human system enables us to reason about current reality, also about past and future events, counterfactuals, hypotheticals. It enables us to work with what developmental psychologists call decoupled content, split apart from our primary model of reality. Factive mental states like knowledge are restricted to taking complements drawn from reality. States of belief can range over that much larger field of decoupled content. And actually, if Hurl and McCormick are right, and again, thanks to Tim Williamson for making me think about this, it's a further restriction on corvids. It's not just that they can only represent attitudes to the real. They can only represent to the attitudes to the real right now, reality at the moment. Humans can also model knowledge of other times. Okay, looking again at the knowledge tasks that corvids succeed at, we glossed them initially in ways that might suggest the corvids were representing what their conspecifics knew about past events of caching. But there's always a way to rewrite these attributions. So the attributed mental content invariably concerns reality as it is right now. The rivals know that these worms are here in the sand. That particular rival does not know that there are peanuts hidden here, but this other one does know that fact about how things are right here, right now. To pass the false belief test, by contrast, there's absolutely no way you can avoid the use of decoupled content. A human could reason that the observer bird falsely believes this tray is inaccessible because he only ever saw it with the cover on it earlier, and I should stash my peanuts in it now that he's not looking, because when we're digging things up later at the party, he won't expect there to be anything here. Like, there's no way of talking through this without going to that decoupled content. And the Eurasian jays aren't capable of that. Their mentalizing horizon is really limited to the content of current reality, and this actually, I think, holds pretty broadly. So if the specific content of another creature's representation of reality differs from reality, corvids haven't demonstrated any capacity to map that content. Now, I've been following most comparative psychologists in just using the words knowledge and ignorance to mark what corvids are attributing to each other in competitive contexts, but a philosopher might worry about this. And in fact, a philosopher does worry about this, and his name is Peter Carruthers. And he's repeatedly characterized non-human animals as representing belief, even false belief. And I'm going to push back on that. I'll start with some research, some of which is actually quite recent, and I think it's unfair to beat up on Peter for it, because he might himself walk back his position a little bit on false leak detection in non-human animals. So there was a lot of excitement about dolphins in the early 2000s with Alain Chudin reporting they seem to be passing a version of the false belief task. But it just now seems that those results do not replicate. So there's a much more comprehensive study by Heather Hill showing that they're not passing. Although the protocol was complicated, and who knows what they might eventually be able to do. But at least they haven't demonstrated their abilities for us in any conclusive way. There was also a lot of excitement about false belief attribution in apes with David Buttleman's helping paradigm experiments. But there again, I think those results aren't very steady. So these are experiments in which apes watch somebody who may or may not have a misconception struggling to get into a box, and then continue on whether there's a misconception. The ape may or may not help them. Beata Prevosser said, no, there's a much easier explanation for what's going on here, that you can explain all the behavior that the apes show just by positing that they are being selfish and greedy and trying to get something that's being represented as more desirable. So there's basically this confound in the experiments. And I think working primarily with children, she demonstrated pretty conclusively that that was what was going on with that. It has been argued that great apes are capable of implicit false belief detection. So they show signs of anticipatory looking. I won't go through the whole wrangle on that, except to say that the anticipatory looking paradigm's under a lot of pressure for not replicating. Human beings don't show, adult humans who have the concept of false belief don't show the right anticipatory looking on these experiments. And so there's just trouble with that. I can go into it in question period if you want to ask. But, and now speaking for Carruthers again, maybe what's hard here isn't the concept of belief per se, it's just the falsity. Right? Because it is hard to maintain a representation that's contrary to your current primary representation of reality. Those are hard things to hold in your head at the same time. So you have to quarantine those things away from each other. So you could say, hey, maybe they're just representing true belief, which would support very similar kinds of action on their part. And now it's going to be really good to look at Gettier cases, right? Because those are situations in which knowledge comes apart from true belief. And let's do that. So there's a 2008 paper by Kaminsky, Kahl, and Tomasello. I think that contains the first experimental demonstration of non-human animals succeeding at identifying the victim of a Gettier case as ignorant. Kaminsky and colleagues missed the significance of this finding because they mischaracterize that Gettier agent as knowing, and they are just baffled at why the chimpanzees are missing this. But that paper involves a kind of complicated betting paradigm experiment. I can talk about it if you want. But I'm going to focus instead on a simpler experiment with monkeys, rhesus monkeys. The interpretation of this monkey experiment, also controversial. Indeed, the original authors advance it as support for the theory that monkeys don't reason in terms of knowledge and ignorance. They reason in terms of awareness relations. And I'm gonna try to argue the awareness relation thing doesn't get you anywhere. And in fact, it's all knowledge and ignorance here. Okay, so in the experiment, monkeys are reacting to the behavior of a human agent who's reaching into a box that may or may not have a fruit in it. There's a makeshift stage with two such boxes, one on each side. The piece of fruit is mounted on dowels, actually secretly controlled by the agent, out of the monkey's view. So the fruit can slide on a track from an exposed position at center stage into either of the boxes. It's important to know, in earlier studies, these monkeys showed that they expected an agent who has seen the fruit slide into one box, a knowledgeable agent, to reach for that correct box, even if the agent is like away from the scene or has their view occluded for a little bit after they see it slide into that side. And Santos's lab, they're using the violation of expectancy paradigm, which really has held up. So this is this tests whether, so basically apes, all of us, will look longer at an unanticipated event. That's how you tell what they were expecting. Okay, so in the new study, the monkey sees the fruit travel from center stage into one of the boxes as the agent's clearly watching. The agent's view of the stage is then occluded by a panel. And at this point, one of two events happens. So the agent can't see. But either the fruit just peeks out of the original box and then goes back in, or the fruit stays exactly where it was and the box flips open and then shut again. The fruit doesn't move. One of those two things happens. Then the rear panel is lowered so the agent can see the scene again and the agent reaches down. The monkeys look longer when the agent reaches into the incorrect, the empty box, but they only do that in conditions where the fruit remains still. If the fruit moves out and back, that expectation that your agent is going to reach accurately is shattered. And the monkeys have no expectation towards either box. They're just expecting the agent to search randomly. And it's really striking that the expectation of accurate reaching disappears if the lemon moves, right? Jogs in and out of the box. Because you might think, look, the fruit's motion should even just like enhance. Yoo-hoo, the fruit's in here, right? Make it all the more likely that the agent's going to reach that spot. Actually, in my view, the most straightforward explanation is the monkey first comes to represent the agent as knowing where the fruit is. That agent saw the fruit go in there. If the fruit's location remains unchanged while the agent's view is briefly occluded, the monkey's attribution of knowledge can just continue intact. But it's shattered if the location of the fruit changes, right? Because remember, knowledge is a mental state you can only hold to truths. As soon as that lemon moves, we've got different truths on the ground. Even if the fruit is later restored to the original spot, its replacement there doesn't happen under the agent's watch, so it can't trigger a fresh mental state attribution of knowledge. So Horschler and colleagues argue that monkeys are attributing an awareness relation here, which stops when the lemon moves. And here's their overview, and you can see, I think I put this on your handout, this quotation. Awareness relations are mentalistic representations, but they're fundamentally different from knowledge or belief-based representations. Awareness representations are hypothesized to have an on-off quality, such that primates either represent an awareness relation, linking a true piece of information to the agent, or they fail to represent any relation between the agent and the information whatsoever. The awareness relations hypothesis predicts that if the information linked to an agent changes while outside that agent's awareness, the awareness relation is turned off, regardless of whether this event results in a mismatch between reality and the agent's belief. In this way, primates tend to make no predictions about how an agent will behave when he or she is ignorant or holds a false belief. Okay, so I think there's a number of moves here that seem right. I like the kind of on-off binary relationship binding the observed agent in some truth. But in my view, seeing the agent as aware that something is the case, that just is a knowledge attribution, like aware that is factive, therefore entailing knowledge. On the sort of positive on side of the on-off relationship, I think I'm pretty close to Horschler and colleagues. It's on the off side that I think they're really getting it wrong. They think there is no attribution of ignorance. There's just a failure to attribute any mental state at all. They think you just stop mentalizing if you're a non-human primate. If there's no awareness relation there, you're just switching it off. And I think that's a mistake. I think part of the difficulty here could be arising from their conceptualization of what ignorance is. So Santos elsewhere characterizes it as a relationship to a decoupled content. So she describes, or with her co-author Alia Martin, ignorance as, quote, a relation between an agent and a piece of information that's not a part of our current reality. But I think that's wrong, right? Because I can characterize you guys as like not knowing like how many fingers I'm holding up here, as being ignorant of that, right? Well, not with this hand, sorry, but this hand. The people who are listening to this on tape have no... Anyway, I should have thought of something that works for the auditory medium, and I can't do that. But in any event, it was part of my current reality, how many fingers I was holding up under that podium unseen. And I think, in fact, this is working for all the stuff with the Corvids, too, right? That there is some feature of reality where the peanuts are hidden. They are representing certain, actively representing certain other birds as not knowing, as being ignorant of. This is occluded from them. It might seem trivial that any creature that can attribute knowledge will be able to attribute ignorance, because otherwise you're just kind of stuck in the on position of the on-off relationship. And you might think, yeah, you're just going to be what? Seeing every agent as knowing about every patch of reality. But I think it's actually kind of an interesting strategy to say, look, the off position is just not actively represented. And they draw attention to the fact that, hey, subjects appear to have no particular expectation about the likely action of the competitor whose view had been blocked at the time of the lemon's motion. Of course, it's unclear what behavior should be expected from an ignorant agent. Neutrality on the options seems as good a representation of ignorance as any other. But I think it's fair game to worry that neutrality is also compatible with just complete failure to mentalize. Horsler and colleagues need to explain the pattern of expectations. And here's what they say. They posit that awareness relations are disrupted by physical movement of objects being tracked by an agent when this motion occurs outside the agent's awareness. I think there's a couple problems here. One is, you're helping yourself to that idea of what's happening outside the agent's awareness, right? Isn't that kind of this idea of ignorance, right? Which is playing a role in your calculations. And also, these guys are just kind of hard coding that when things move, that shuts down your awareness relations. Who knows why? Here's their final move against explanations in terms of knowledge and ignorance. And it runs as follows. I think I put this on your handout. Quote, a subject who represented these events in terms of the agent's knowledge / ignorance should have expected the agent to reach correctly, regardless of whether the fruit or the box moved when the agent couldn't see, as in both cases, the agent maintained knowledge of the object's ultimate location. Instead, monkeys' conceptions of the agent's knowledge of the fruit's location appear to be disrupted or rendered null when the target object moves while out of the agent's view. So I agree representations of the agent's knowledge got canceled by its movement. What's wrong is the suggestion that the agent actually maintained knowledge of the fruit's ultimate location during both versions of the crucial sequence. As soon as the lemon moves, the occluded agent doesn't know where it is, right? Loses knowledge of the current location of the thing. And therefore, in the absence of any reason to expect its replacement, the agent was also ignorant of its ultimate location. There could also be something about this ultimate location thing, which is a little bit out of line with what animals can represent in terms of the model of the here and now. Okay, the relationship between motion and loss of knowledge, that doesn't have to be posited as a brute fact, the way these guys are just positing, hey, it's just a brute fact about awareness relations that when things move, they drop. Given that knowledge is an attitude of a type one can hold only to truths, right? It's just following from the general characterization of knowledge. So I think this is a Gettier case in which the agent's true belief falls short of knowledge despite being subjectively indistinguishable from knowledge for that agent. And there's something like really intriguing here, especially for those who see mind reading as being about that agent-focused thing. What will those pesky agents do next? Because that Gettier agent and the knowing agent should be expected to behave exactly the same way. They're closely paired at that initial moment when they both watch the lemon go into the box. And then remember, if the lemon doesn't move while they're not observing, then the expectation is that they'll reach accurately. If you kind of switch to consider the subjective perspective of the agent during that sequence, the Gettier agent and the knowing agent have the same experience, right? From behind because the screen is up when the lemon moves. And there's no question at all, the observing animal knows the truth about where the fruit is. Indeed, this location has been rendered even more salient by the lemon sliding in and out. But, you know, despite all of that, one case is correctly grasped by the observing monkey as supporting appropriate action and the other isn't. And it can just look like a bizarre defect of mind reading that the observing monkey drops the expectation of a successful reach in Gettier cases. They would have predicted better if they had expected a correct reach from that agent who had a coincidentally true belief. And think, so monkeys look bad if we're comparing them to humans who have the concept of belief as well as the concept of knowledge. But if we evaluate them strictly on whether they are accurately discriminating between states of knowledge and ignorance, their performance looks better. Their right to respond differently to these cases in general, you got to think about like what generalizations are they making. The object-seeking behavior of knowledgeable agents really is different from the object-seeking behavior of ignorant agents. Okay, so last section. Agent-focused mind reading is just trying to predict behavior, where this can be driven by factors like false belief, decoupled from current reality. World-focused mind reading aims to take the actions of sensitive and smart agents as cues to what's happening in reality. We need to learn generalizations about when to watch those cues and when to drop them. If we come to see other sentient creatures as smart about the ranges of reality that fall within the ambit of their senses, earshot, line of sight, etc., then it makes sense that mental state attributions can be updated not only by the recognition that the target creature has witnessed some relevant change, but also by the recognition that they've failed to catch something. If reality deviates from the target agent's conception of it, say, after the agent's back is turned, then that agent just isn't an expert anymore on that portion of reality. As soon as the lemon moves, the focal monkey's grasp of what's going on in that stage is superior to that of the target agent whose view is blocked. So you've got this idea that sentient creatures are local experts on the fields of their current and recent experience, and it gains force when you think of cases where those recognized fields differ from those of the observing mind reader. And those cases are ubiquitous. So other creatures invariably have different angles of view. They stand poised to react to threats that could be looming up behind you. They are drawn to attractive rewards just out of your range of view. So they can actually kind of function as like rear view or side view mirrors for you if you have some conception of how their sensibilities work. Going back to the beginning, gaze following can be understood as a form of deference to the sentience of others. If another bird in the flock looks up, that's potentially a marker of a serious threat overhead. Whatever might have crossed the peripheral vision of that single animal to attract its attention upwards. Even if it didn't independently attract the attention of other members of the flock, it can now do so quickly through their capacity to read that first bird's response. Reading the response correctly demands some appreciation of the spatial zone towards which this response applies, starting with a grasp of line of sight. In this way, distal events can register with mind-reading agents in social settings, even when those events didn't initially fall within the scope of what these mind-reading agents could sense directly for themselves. I think it's really easy to forget this side of mind-reading in epistemology, where attributors who are invited to evaluate the mental state of the subject in the case typically have a God's eye perspective on the case. We know everything that the target agent does, and we know a bunch more things besides, like about the brain tumor and the mirrors and everything else. So we're looking down on the agent when we read a case in epistemology, typically. Even in mind reading research, with the exception of some work on attributions of knowledge, WH, like that container swap thing, researchers typically focus on the judgment of attributors who don't need to rely on the targets they're witnessing for clues to what's going on in the environment. This choice of epistemic context leaves the predicted actions of the observed agents as the only focus of experimental attention. The focal child who watches the unwitnessed transfer task always knows where the key object is. Even as the observed agent is fooled, epistemically, that focal child is looking down on the target agent throughout the sequence. But in ordinary life, The agents we encounter as peers typically know much that we do not, given their different angles of view and history of experience. And in fact, our encounters with them can be mutually informative exactly because of these discrepancies in our expertise. Because knowledge is factive, mind readers who can spot knowledge in other agents can deduce the state of the world from those agents' actions. Social cognition lets us help ourselves to the knowledge of others in making sense of reality. Humans have this animal system too, but we add one weird trick, a trick which generates stunning results that we'll talk about next time. Thank you.